From the beautiful campus of Texas A&M University, the Sidney and J.L. Huffines Institute for Sports Medicine and Human Performance in the Department of Health and Kinesiology brings you the Sports Medicine Podcast. Our mission is to make sense of and connect the science, practice, and application of the latest findings in sports medicine and human performance to the real world. Here's our host, the director of the Huffines Institute, Dr. Tim Lightfoot.
Well, hello, and welcome to the weekly podcast from the Huffines Institute for Sports Medicine and Human Performance. I'm your host, Tim Lightfoot, and I want to thank you so much for taking the time to download us and listen to us. This week, we're bringing you another interesting individual in the world of sports medicine and human performance. We are very, very fortunate to have with us one of the prominent journalists that's working in the area of sports writing right now, by the name of Patrick Ruby. Welcome to the podcast, Patrick.
Great to be here. Looking forward to talking about this very complicated and important issue.
Yeah, well, thank you. I'm going to tell the audience a little bit about you so they'll know why we have you on anyway, and then we'll just kind of jump into it. Patrick is a writer for the Sports of Earth and the Washington Times. He's an award-winning journalist. He for several years now, his writings have been selected for the Best American Sports Writing books, if you catch those in the bookstore. He contributes to the Washingtonian Magazine, the Atlantic Online, ESPN, Reader's Digest, and many more. Yeah. He has a Master's of Science in Journalism from Northwestern University's Medill School of Journalism. And in 2012, he was the Virginia Press Association's first place feature story portfolio winner. Again, thanks for being with us today, Patrick.
Thanks for rallying off some of my resume and career highlights. Makes me feel more impressive maybe than I actually am.
No. Most of us you accomplish these things and we kind of are all very humble about it, so we're just glad to have you. Tell the audience today that I reached out to you and connected with you because of a piece that you wrote for Sports of Earth. It came out last week about some of the ongoing things that are going on with the NFL concussion lawsuits that are happening. Mm-hmm. And one of the great pieces you wrote, and just for a quick update for the audience, there are about, I think, 4,000 former players that are now suing the NFL for concussion-related injuries. And your piece last week was really about how the NFL has, we'll say, controlled that for the time being. I'll let you take it from there. Tell the audience a little bit about some of the things that you wrote about.
Sure. Well, this is a complicated topic. And just to bring people up to speed that maybe haven't read a lot about it, you're right, there are more than 4,000 former players. That's something in the range of about a third of all the current living former players.
Wow.
Have brought lawsuits against the league over brain trauma and concussions. And I do think it's important to say brain trauma and not just concussions, because we really are talking about brain trauma more broadly.
Yeah, and people forget that concussion is a brain injury, don't
exactly.
they? I mean, they tend to use the word concussion, and it really kind of devalues what's happening. But yeah, you're right. Brain trauma.
Exactly, because there are different types of injuries. And as we're discovering as a science, obviously, subconcussive blows also can cause a lot of brain trauma. But we'll get into that later. In terms of these suits, the gist to really know, if you haven't read about already, is that what the players and the plaintiffs are saying and accusing the NFL of is that the NFL basically knew of and hid or did not disclose and did not inform these players of the full risks of football-induced brain trauma.
Right.
How does that work in a practical sense? Well, essentially, it means things like, the NFL... there was outside science that said, this is a pretty serious injury. Your return to play guidelines need to be, you can't just go back on the field the same day when you have a concussion, things like that.
Right.
But the NFL ignored kind of all that, told the players it was okay, told the players there was no link between getting concussions and getting hit in the head, and any kind of long-term cognitive damage, all these sorts of things. Essentially, that's what the lawsuits, and that's what the argument in the lawsuits is really about.
Yeah,
let me
interject here. I relayed this to you in an email. As I have read about this, I've kind of thought, what's the deal here? These guys knew this was a dangerous game in the first place. They knew these kind of things were a possibility, and they went ahead and played anyway. And now why are they blaming the NFL? And as I told you, I think my attitude on that has changed 180 degrees, because as you have really shown, there really was a I hate to use the term cover up, but that's kind of the best thing I can use right now. And I think that's what you're about to talk about a little bit.
Yeah, no, exactly. And, you know, your question is a question lots of people have asked me, whether it's people that reached out to me on email, leaving comments on things I've written, comments that I see on other stories about this issue. You're right. A lot of people say, well, sure, playing football means getting hit in the head. Getting hit in the head means that you have a risk of brain damage. Duh. You know, how can these people turn around and sue? You know, doesn't that make any sense? Didn't they know? And as I wrote about, the NFL players, they didn't know. They weren't told. And what I wrote about specifically last week is a guy named Elliot Kelman. Hmm. Now, who is Elliot Kelman? Elliot Kelman was, until recently, a longtime team doctor with the New York Jets. By training, he's a rheumatologist, which means he specializes in joint and muscle.
Not in concussions.
So far, so good.
Yeah.
So far, so good, right? In terms of, you know, for a sports team doctor, that makes sense, right?
Right.
Now, back in 1994, we got to go back in time here, the NFL started to get concerned about concussions. If you think back, I don't know if you guys remember, but, you know, players like Steve Young were getting quite a few concussions, Troy Aikman. If you guys remember a New York Jets receiver named Al Toon, who had something like 9 concussions diagnosed in his career, had to retire because of post-concussive, what they called then post-concussive syndrome.
Mm-hmm.
That's headaches, light sensitivity, memory problems, all the things we now know about a little bit better.
Mm-hmm.
So the NFL decided, okay, we're going to put together, the NFL put together a committee. They called it their Mild Traumatic Brain Injury Committee. It's basically their concussion committee. And then, you know, we're going to study this problem. So Elliot Kelman, who, again, not a neurologist, no real training in brain science whatsoever or brain health, was installed as the chairman of the committee. Now, fast forward to the mid-2000s. While lots of other outside science, like I said before, was talking about the dangers involved here,
mm-hmm.
while other outside sports science and medicine organizations were putting forward return to play guidelines that basically said you can't come back on the field the same day. Concussions are serious injuries. You need to be, you know, examined by qualified neurologists. You need to take these things slow. All the sort of things that, in a way, we sort of take more for granted now,
but
didn't then. These things were being said. But at the same time, these things were being said. The NFL committee was doing its own studies. Now, these studies were insular, and they were closed. And they were coming up with completely contradictory conclusions. They were saying things like, and I quote, concussions in professional football are not serious injuries. That's a direct quote, not a serious injury. They were saying that concussed players, based on their data, could safely be allowed to return to play on the same day. And also, here's the other thing, and this is where the idea of, you know, cover-up comes into play. Not only were they saying this, they were going out and actually attacking and attempting to discredit outside researchers that were saying the opposite.
So this just wasn't a scientific disagreement.
No,
you know, maybe a couple of different studies done differently, and you'll have disagreements amongst scientists about things that happen.
Sure.
From the tone of the things that were said and written, you think that this was on behalf of the NFL, this committee was out attacking other scientists, trying to discredit the other science to make it seem like concussions were less serious than they really were.
I mean, I think the evidence that has already been made public, and again, in the state of those lawsuits, we haven't gotten to the discovery process yet. So we don't know the sort of internal memos.
Mm.
We don't know what was going on inside this committee.
Right.
But just based on the basis of what they've done publicly and what's already been out there, I think that it's fair to say that at the very least, they have their head in the sand.
Yeah.
And it's really hard to understand how they have their head in the sand if it wasn't somewhat purposeful.
Yeah.
I'll give you a few examples of that.
Okay.
First of all, in terms of Pelman, you know, neuropsychologists, they jokingly called him Mr. Pelman, not Dr. Pelman.
Mm.
And here's one guy had a quote. One doctor, he talked to Peter Keating of ESPN Magazine, and this was back in 2006. Peter Keating, by the way, is the guy that really first blew the whistle on some of this stuff. When you go and look at the actual lawsuits against the league, some of his reporting in the ESPN, the magazine, it's at the center of a lot of these lawsuits.
Mm-hmm.
And here's a quote from one of the doctors, the neuroscientist that talked to Keating. He said, "I would hear Elliot Kalman say things in speeches like, 'I don't know about much about concussion. I learn from my players, and we as a field don't know much about concussion.' And it used to bother me," this doctor said. "He knew what to do about concussions, but he was acting like it was new ground."
Right.
So you've got them. You've got this NFL committee headed by Kalman. And by the way, they're founded in 1994. It takes them until 2003 to put out their first paper.
Wow.
Even in the academic world, it's a pretty long time.
Yeah, that you wouldn't have a job very long in the academic world if one paper in 9 years.
Right, and they're not even guys who are out there fighting for grant funding, right? They're being funded by the NFL.
Right.
So they published this series of papers in the mid-2000s. Like I said, they concluded that even if you're knocked unconscious, you could safely return to play on the same day. They said that returning to play after concussion doesn't involve significant risk of a second concussion in the same game or during that season. They said that if you had previous concussions, you had no risk of repeated concussions. And they said, this is the real bad one. They said there was no evidence, that's a direct quote, no evidence that multiple concussions produce worsening injury or chronic cumulative effect.
Wow.
Now, we know that none of that is true.
That's correct.
Again, the science, the brain is a black box. I mean, I'm sure people you've talked to before said that too.
Yeah.
There's a lot we don't fully understand. There's a lot about the mechanism of concussion we don't totally understand. The mechanism of these other types of brain trauma we don't totally understand. We're still figuring that out. We're still figuring out how to diagnose, how to image. There is some art to this as well as science.
Yeah.
That's all true. That being said, we do know that these are serious injuries. We do know that there's significant risk that, A, if you go back out the same day that you've been concussed, of getting a much worse injury, something like second impact syndrome. Yeah. We know there's a significant risk of, you have one concussion, you're more likely to get more. We know that repeated blows to the head, whether they're concussive or subconcussive, absolutely increase your risk of chronic effects later on, whether you're talking about CTE or other types of cognitive dysfunction. And we didn't just start knowing this like in 2009, 2010. We've known that for a while. And that's what's crazy is that there was a lot of other outside research going on. And like I said, it seemed like this NFL committee was ignoring or actively attacking.
It is interesting that over the last few years, as the new commissioner has come in, he has basically said, Roger Goodell has said that, player safety is number one. And one of the things that you point out is that if player safety is number one, why is this Kalman still involved?
Great point. And that was the genesis of this article was I recently found, so just to give you the context, Kalman in 2007 resigned as the chairman of the NFL's concussion committee, but he was still on the committee.
Hmm.
He was on the committee roughly until about 2009-ish, early 2010. If you remember when Roger Goodell and some other people from the NFL went before Congress and they had hearings on this.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you remember, but they, I don't know how to put it in vernacular, they had their butts handed to them by Congress, basically.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And they were called to the carpet for what they basically hadn't been doing on this issue. After that happened, the NFL basically disbanded its old concussion committee. It formed a new committee, including quite a few people that had been critics of the NFL's previous science and previous approach.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, I sort of figured, like a lot of people, Kalman's out of the picture. But it, like I said, I found out a couple weeks ago and I wrote about it. It turns out he's still the medical advisor to the NFL.
Wow.
Now, I asked the NFL about this, and they told me, look, Elliot Kalman is our medical advisor. They said he doesn't have input on the specific, new concussion committee they have. They said he doesn't make policy. Well, okay, I don't know if that's true or not. I'll take them at their word. The NFL's a very opaque organization. It's really hard to know what's going on behind the scenes. They're a private organization. They don't need to make a lot of things public.
Yeah.
But that being said, again, just by sort of combing through reports, Kalman has been somewhat involved with brain-related stuff. I can give you a few examples of that. You remember 3 years ago, there was a Philadelphia Eagles game. I think most people remember this, where the quarterback, Kevin Cobb, at the time, and also a linebacker, Stuart Bradley. They were both concussed during the game, and, like, visibly so. You could see it on TV. And they were allowed to keep playing before they were eventually pulled off the field.
Mm-hmm.
So the league looks into this because they had just established their new concussion guidelines. Again, it took until 2010, basically, to be like, okay, if you're concussed, you have to be taken out of the game. The league looked into it, and the person they had speak to the Eagles trainers was Elliot Pelman. So in some way, he's involved there.
Right.
You guys are pretty familiar with Colt McCoy, the old Texas quarterback, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Colt McCoy, yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, you remember with the Browns a few years ago, he was concussed on a brutal helmet-to-helmet hit.
Right.
James Harrison with the Steelers. I think almost everybody saw this hit.
Mm-hmm.
And
there was no doubt. When he came back out, you could look him in the eyes, and you knew he was concussed.
Oh, yeah. He was kind of stumbling a little bit. And the Browns trainer somehow failed to administer a sideline, just a standard diagnostic test on the sideline. Again, those tests aren't perfect, but at least you have to be administering them.
Right.
You have to be trying. And they failed. Somehow they failed to do that. I mean, that was a big deal. I mean, that became a national story. McCoy's father, who is, a high school football coach or a former high school football coach down in Texas, is not necessarily someone who is completely, anti-football or prone to what some people would consider exaggeration about this issue. You know, he was livid about this. He spoke out publicly about it. So, again, the league sends a representative to talk to Brown's official on what happened. Who do they send? They send Pelman.
Yeah.
And then the same season, you guys remember Mike Vick, at this point, who was the quarterback for the Eagles, got concussed, had to sit out a week. Again, according to new NFL procedures, he had to be examined by an independent neurologist before he could return. Who picked the independent neurologist? Well, according to the Eagles trainer, Pelman was involved in that selection process, which is weird on two levels. One, again, why is he involved with anything related to players' brains? I was a player in the NFL. I don't want this guy near that whole process. Two, with the independent neurologist, why is anyone from the NFL helping select the guy?
Right.
I thought that was kind of strange, too.
Right.
Because, again, as you guys know, I mean, the whole situation with team doctors and conflicts of interest is very real.
Mm-hmm.
It's real in college sports. It's real in pro sports. And there's lots of documented cases where, you know, even when you have ethical, you know, upstanding, good doctors that want to do right by their patient, they're being put into a compromising position because who's paying their salary?
Yep.
So that's a whole other issue, but just wanted to bring that up.
Yeah, well, I think that's a great point, and I wrote a blog last week about that because one of our former podcast folks, Dave Epstein, wrote a big article in Sports Illustrated about the Penn State issues.
Right
in that area. So, that's a huge that whole conflict of interest thing with the teams themselves picking the doctors. That's a huge conflict of interest there.
I think so. And the NFL is even, you know, I don't know if this happens or not at the college level. In the NFL, you know, again, also, the teams don't only pick these doctors, but a lot of times doctors bid to be the team doctor in that town because it's really great for their business.
Yeah, yeah.
So there's like a double conflict of interest. So there's a whole commercial interest of not only do you want the, you know, you want to be the team doctor and they're paying you whatever they're paying you to be the team doctor, but you sort of want to keep that relationship because it's helping your normal business too.
Yeah.
So it's a really dicey thing. You know, I think in an ideal world, honestly, I think what you would see is I think the Players Association would be the one, you know, funding the doctors for their own care, basically.
Right.
They wouldn't be connected to the teams.
Right.
And, you know, the same thing, somehow in college, you have the same thing where, well, if you had a player, this is something I've advocated for. If you had some sort of players union or Players Association, again, they would be the ones selecting these doctors, and, you know, again, not necessarily the teams or the schools, because there's just an inherent conflict of interest there, even with good people.
How does what the NFL has done in the past compare with what other sports that have the high potential of brain injury or concussion? How does it compare with other sports like hockey, like boxing, and the attention that has been given in those sports to it? Have they been similarly in behind, or is the NFL the one behind all them, or how does that comparison go?
You know, I think in general they've been somewhat similarly behind. With hockey, I know hockey has been looking at this problem for a while, and maybe in some ways was a little bit ahead in terms of not rushing players back to play so quickly.
Mm-hmm.
But they've got a whole, the same problems with conflict of interest, same problems with players not wanting to disclose the injury, teams not wanting, you know, the whole don't ask, don't tell problem, so to speak, the whole financial incentives that go with that, which can be a whole other thorny set of issues. I think boxing is almost a state-by-state thing because it depends on what that state's athletic commission rules are.
Mm-hmm.
I think in general, actually, boxing is a little bit better in terms of if you've been knocked out cold. There, I think a lot of states have there's a certain number of days or a month or something before you're allowed to fight again, which, again, is a really crude sort of protection, especially given the fact that it's boxing and you're just getting all these subconcussive blows all the time.
Right.
I'm not going to necessarily say that boxing is so much better on this, but I think that's one way in which maybe they were a little bit ahead, even if the sport itself is even more of a greater risk than even football. In terms of other levels of football, I mean, I don't think there's been anything standard. There was never anything standardized at all in sort of youth football, high school football, and the NCAA, arguably at this point, is well behind. It's inarguably well behind even what the NFL is doing.
Yeah.
Which is a whole other something that I've written about, and we could talk about separately or talk about now if you want to.
Well, I think it's just an interesting topic to try to understand how these big organizations are trying to come to grips with this. One of the things that we've talked with, especially with some team physicians that we've had on the podcast, as well as athletic trainers, is for those folks, that balance between the player's safety and the desire to have the best athlete on the field at the time. And we've been privileged that the ones that we have talked to have always said, without a doubt, player safety comes first. But in your article, when you talked about Pellman and some of his interactions with the Jets players, there was no doubt that he wasn't there for their long-term best interest. He was there for the team's best interest short-term.
Well, yeah, there's an incredible exchange. This was originally reported in the New York Daily News. And then also was referenced in that Peter Keating ESPN Magazine article I talked about. What's happened back in 2003, and it's between Elliot Pellman and a wide receiver named Wayne Corbett. Sure, anyone who follows football remembers him. He was a really good receiver for the Jets for many years, and basically concussions and brain trauma forced him out of the league and forced him to retire. So there's a 2003 game. Jets are playing the Giants. Corbett gets knocked out. This is the description of what happens next. So you see Pellman standing on the sideline. The fourth quarter, he's looking at him. He says, there's going to be some controversy about you going back to play. But this is very important for you. This is very important for your career. And he asks them, are you okay? When Corbett says, I'm fine, Pellman sends him back into the game. Now, this is even though he knew that Corbett had been knocked out cold. He knew that he had been concussed. He put him through some mental tests on the sideline, and Corbett was performing okay on his memory exercises, which, again, they don't necessarily tell you is, A, if someone's been concussed, B, they certainly don't tell you if someone should go back out there and get hit in the head again or be at risk for that.
Right.
It's very, even in 2003, it's, in my opinion, a very, very irresponsible thing to do. Now, there was no NFL policy against that at the time. Again, the NFL is going off its own committee's work. It's going off Pellman's committee's work, and Pellman's committee is saying that this is totally fine. That NFL sort of standard operating procedure, at the time, 50% of players that were concussed in games were going right back in. That's from their own statistics at the time.
Yeah.
That was just the way things were done, and they were okay with that. So, that's the thing about this. You can look at them and say, well, these are just sort of scientific fights, they're academic fights, or they're sort of esoteric, but they're not because they have huge implications for the policy of that trainer on the sideline and what decision they're going to make. The coach, what's going to inform their decision, If a coach is being told at some level concussions are not serious injuries, then of course he's going to tell his players, get back out there, right?
Yeah.
Play through it. It's a bruise. It's kind of, it goes with the whole football ethos. You need to have all this sort of science there.
Yeah.
You need to have this expertise there to inform the decisions about the guys that are on the field.
Well, Patrick, let me ask you, surely there were other folks involved that were speaking out against this, even within NFL. Certainly, they weren't all going along like sheep with this. Has there been any blowback? First of all, have you gotten any flack over this kind of reporting? Has there been anybody that was involved, maybe internally, that's gotten blowback on some of this stuff or got flack over their stance?
Well, sure. First of all, I haven't gotten any personal blowback, but I'm sure that I'm not on the NFL's Christmas card list. I can guarantee you that.
You're not going to the Christmas party, huh?
No, they're a very obviously well-funded organization. They have incredibly bright lawyers in charge. They have very smart public relations people in charge. Look, the old commissioner before talking to Boo was Pete Rozelle. Mm. Pete Rozelle, was a PR person.
Yeah.
That was how he made his mark. So, the law and PR is in their DNA, and they're very good at both. So they don't necessarily need to blow back on particular reporters.
Mm-hmm.
They sort of be good at sort of shaping the narrative, and much like, a good political campaign, I want to say they control the media, because they don't, but they definitely are good at sort of shaping what gets into the media and what gets out. But anyway, that being said, in terms of actual people inside or involved in the NFL, sure, there was one person I talked to in particular, a guy named Bill Barr. Now, he is at New York University. He's a neuropsychologist. He was working with Pellman. He worked with him as a consulting neuropsychologist for the Jets. And a lot of what he did was basically he would give preseason baseline tests on players.
Yeah.
And then he would evaluate them again after they had been concussed. And I talked to Bill, and Bill said, for a while his working relationship with Pellman was good. He said there were clear boundaries. He said he would just provide his objective information, test these guys, they've got cognitive dysfunction, or they don't, depending on what the test says, and that Pellman was in charge of the actual return to play decision. But Bill told me he felt that Pellman listened to his opinions and respected what he had to say, and he said at that time, which was the early 2000s, he had no real problem with Pellman. And he said things changed in 2004. And here again, this is a good example of what was kind of going on behind the scenes. So Bill Barr is a research scientist.
Mm-hmm.
So he is doing stuff that doesn't involve the NFL. And one of the things he was doing was a big study of, he was collaborating with some other guys, including some guys down in North Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
The Bell Law studies on this, Kevin Giskowitz, some other people. They did a study of almost 3,000 college athletes who had been concussed. And the study basically just found a lot of things. But one of the things that found that was interesting to Barr was that the best time to conduct those follow-up neuropsychological tests of players who have been concussed, to see how they're doing, is actually to wait until their symptoms, the headaches, light sensitivity, nausea, those more obvious symptoms of being concussed, wait for those symptoms to completely clear. Now, in general, as that takes usually about 5 to 10 days after the injury.
That means a player would have to be out for 5 or 10 days, huh?
Exactly. In the NFL, they were having Barr come in and give these tests on Monday, or maybe on Tuesday, because the NFL wanted to get these guys back on the field as quickly as possible.
Yeah.
So a different standard there. Again, like I said, that's an example of how these academic sites actually have a really big impact on the ground decision making. So what happens? Barr does the study, he goes to a brain injury conference in New York. He basically just presents his findings and just says, look, the time for us to test these guys is 5 to 10 days, not 1 to 2.
Yeah.
He says a week later he got an angry phone call from Pellman. And Pellman had already told him that he didn't believe in the findings of the study. And Barr's like, look, this is impeccable design, careful research. Barr didn't know what to make of that. Now Pellman's on the phone angry, and he's saying, you're saying bad things about the NFL. And he tells Barr, if you ever want to talk about sports concussions at all publicly, you have to clear it with me.
Wow.
So Bill Barr, now he's a consultant, but he's also an NYU faculty member. He is a researcher. In fact, he's thinking to himself, I have a way more of a research background than you do. And you're not even a neurologist. He's like, you can't tell me what to say about concussions. So Barr basically says, look, that's not going to happen. And he says Coleman fired him immediately.
Hmm.
Now, Coleman denied that this conversation took place along those lines, but he did admit that he fired Barr, and he refused to say why. Again, that was in Peter Keating's ESPN magazine article.
Yeah.
But again, you know, in my judgment is, well, who do I believe here? Who's more likely to be telling the truth?
Right. The person with the person with a conflict of interest or the one without.
Right. Exactly. The person that has something to lose here or the person that doesn't.
Yeah.
And I talked to Barr. This happened in 2004. I talked to Barr a couple weeks ago about it. He's still upset. He's not upset at not having this NFL gig. He's upset at that notion of you have to clear what you say with the NFL or with me.
Yeah.
I mean, basically, his sort of research and scientific and moral integrity was just offended by that notion, you know, as it should have been.
Yeah.
And I think that kind of stuck with him. And that really, that sort of soured him on some of the stuff that was going on in the NFL in general.
Wow. Well, Patrick, we are running out of time here, and a fascinating story. And I have a feeling that there's more chapters of this that we don't know about that are going to come out pretty soon.
I think that there's, those lawsuits, right now they're sort of hung up on some procedural decisions. Basically, is this a matter actually for a jury trial?
Yeah.
Or is this a matter, as the NFL is arguing, that should be handled by an arbitrator through collective bargaining agreement? Once the federal courts rule on that, and they're expected to rule sometime this summer, and then whatever appeal process comes out of that, again, it will be like a legal dogfight from start to finish. If we ever get to the point where there's an actual discovery process and the plaintiff's lawyers are allowed to subpoena all the memos, all the correspondence, all the paperwork from the concussion committee, they're allowed to depose Hellman and some of the other people that were on it, you're right, we're going to find out a lot more one way or the other. And just, again, my sort of reporter spider sense is that it probably isn't going to be great for the NFL.
Yeah.
If that stuff becomes public. And I actually think there's a good chance, if this cases are allowed to go through, there's a good chance that we'll see some sort of big global settlement before we'll ever see that stuff become public.
Yeah, they just won't want it to come out in public.
I think it would be an absolute public relations nightmare for them.
Yeah. So what's one take-home message that you would give our audience to take away from this conversation?
Boy, I guess my take-home message would be, given the fact that Pellman is still giving medical advice to the league, given that a couple of guys that were on that original concussion committee are still on the new concussion committee, and some other guys that were on there are still affiliated with the league in various sort of medical-connected ways, and whether it's advisory roles, consulting roles, things like that. Given that the NFL has kind of painted itself into a corner where, on one hand, they want to be seen as doing more for player safety, and they are. But on the other hand, because of this legal situation and them not wanting to be liable for things, they can't fully repudiate sort of the bad work and bad stuff that they were doing.
Yeah.
I think the takeaway is just, it's almost like the old Ronald Reagan cliche about how to approach the Soviet Union, trust but verify, right? When we had arms control with Gorbachev,
right,
you remember
right,
that?
Right.
Your listeners are old enough to remember that.
Right.
I think with the NFL and their sort of come-to-Jesus turn on brain safety, I think we need to all have a trust but verify approach. When the NFL announces big grants to study brain research, you need to look at the fine print. What are they actually studying? What are they actually doing? When they announce, we've got a new committee, who's actually on it? What kind of work are they really doing? When they announce, we've got these new standards in place, hold them accountable. Are they really following those standards? Are players being helped as much as possible?
Yeah.
Are we doing as much as we can for safety? It's one thing for Roger Goodell to say, I've got a relentless focus on player health and safety. That sounds nice. Another thing for him to go on Face the Nation before the Super Bowl, which is what he did, and say, or basically deny that there was a link between getting hit in the head repeatedly in football and long-term brain trauma.
Yeah.
We know there's a link. We don't know the extent of it. We don't know all the mechanisms, but we know there's a link. And knowing that is enough to do something, and really it's enough to err on the side of caution.
Right.
And that's something I think everyone should take away is, the fact that we don't know how all this works with the brain isn't reason for us to be cavalier or to be like, well, science, maybe they'll figure something out. In the meantime, let's just keep on keeping on. I think it's reason for us to be much more cautious and always err on the side of, you know, we all like football, whether it's to play or watch or enjoy, but we don't really understand the risk. We just know that it's bad enough that we should really be more careful than we've been about it.
Yeah. We do want these players to have a life after football.
Absolutely, absolutely. There's no amount of glory is worth, you know, I've done so many stories about guys who are in the, you know, guys who are in their 50s and have no memory and their family life has fallen apart. I've talked to guys in their early 30s. These are guys who won't even go on record. They've contacted me privately. All they did was play high school football, and they've got memory and cognition issues, and they're afraid to tell anyone about it because they don't want to lose their job.
Right, right.
You know, that's really scary. I mean, again, I can't tell you how many people like that are out there. I don't know. You know, these are anecdotal kids. These are people, like I said, that reached out to me privately. But it's, you know, we're not just, the thing to remember and take home is we're not just talking about the NFL. We're talking about college kids that play college football, and we're talking about high school and senior kids. We're talking about, you know, your sons, your nephews, your brothers. All these people that are sort of, in some ways, in the middle of a giant, uncontrolled experiment right now.
Right. And so this really can hit home, if you'll pardon the pun, I guess. And I think everybody needs to be aware of it. And certainly those of us that enjoy football, we need to be aware of it. I want to thank you, Patrick, for being with us today. It's been a great and illuminating talk for us, and I hope that the audience has gotten as much out of it as I have.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome. And for those of you listening, thank you for being with us. Our producer, Cheryl, she has our podcast question of the week here.
What committee was formed in the NFL to handle concussion injuries in the sport?
Great question. Be the first one to email us the correct answer for that. Email it to huffinespodcast@hlkn.tamu.edu. And if you're the first one, you will get one of those nifty podcast t-shirts that we have. Again, thank you, Patrick, for being with us. And thank all of you for downloading us and listening to us this week. We hope that you join us next week, and we'll have another interesting individual from the world of sports medicine and human performance on the podcast. And until then, we hope that you stay active and healthy.
The Sports Medicine Podcast is produced by Cheryl Marek and Kelly Selman and licensed by the Huffines Institute at Texas A&M under a Creative Commons 3.0 license. You can share it as much as you want, and you can talk or blog about it all you want. Just don't change it or charge money for it. This podcast is made possible by support from the Omar Smith family and the Sydney and J.L. Huffines family. Our music was composed, performed, and graciously provided by Dave Zellner Productions, your source for quality music and music production since 1992. Find them at www.davidzellner.com. Our opening and closing credits were provided by John Miles Productions at johnmilesproductions.com. If you have questions or comments, please send them to huffinespodcast@hlkn.tamu.edu. From all of us at the Huffines Institute, we hope you have an active and healthy week.